Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
Malombo was a flavor before English. Honeyed and tart, it slid across my tongue like a marble in a pinball machine.
Today on our show, feast your ears on the sound of Yele Kamara's voice reading her poem about a childhood food memory. Learn about research on the foods we eat and how they might affect hormonal responses in an interview with anthropologist and human biologist Michael Wasserman. And discover your new favorite summer salad featuring blueberries, Thai basil, and wild rice. That's all coming up in the next half hour, so stay tuned to Earth Eats. Let's start with Alex Chambers and some food news. Hello, Alex.
Hi, Kate. We have an update today on the farm bill as it makes its way through the Senate, and a story about one way dairy farmers are dealing with the slump in milk prices. The U.S. Senate is poring over amendments to the farm bill as Congress pushes to pass the sweeping agriculture legislation this summer. Senate Agriculture Chairman Pat Roberts wants to see the farm bill passed before the 4th of July recess. But tussles over amendments could put a wrench in that plan. Tennessee Senator Bob Corker has proposed adding import tariffs, which would roll back Trump's trade authority. Earlier this month, Corker failed to get tariffs added to the defense authorization bill, which passed last week. But Chairman Roberts and Senator Debbie Stabenow have been skeptical, saying the amendment could bog down the bill's chance for speedy passage. Meanwhile, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin proposed an amendment that would limit crop insurance subsidies for the wealthiest farms. The amendment would reduce the subsidies for farmers who earn over $1.4 million a year by 15% and would save taxpayers almost $500 million over the next decade. According to the Environmental Working Group, the farms in the top 10% of sales get 70% of all crop insurance subsidies. And South Dakota Senator John Thune has proposed lifting restrictions for some livestock to graze on USDA conservation land. As milk prices and morale plummet to historic lows, dairy farmers are forced to reckon with the market any way they can. And in some cases, they're turning to beer. But not to drink. The New York Times last week wrote about several dairy operations across the country that are repurposing their equipment and infrastructure to brew craft beer. If you do the math, it makes sense. A pint of beer sells for $7. A pint of raw milk sells wholesale for around 16 cents, which is less than what it costs to produce. For many dairy farmers who can't make the transition, there is little relief in sight. The dairy market has gotten so bad in recent months, the dairy co-op AgriMark sent a letter to its members saying it plans to create a mental health assistance program after three of its members committed suicide in recent years. Some worry that new tariffs under the Trump administration will further exacerbate the dairy industry's problems. For Stone Cow Brewery in Barre, Massachusetts, brewing and selling beer helps them hang on to their agricultural roots while looking to the future of their business. Now, when you leave the dairy, you might have a gallon of milk in one hand and a growler of farm-brewed beer in the other. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow for those reports.
Thank you, Alex.
My pleasure, Kate.
Summertime is the season for celebrating fruits. It's berry picking and peaches, watermelon and plums. For poet Yaeli Kamara, one fruit stands out in her memory, a fruit connecting her to the homeland of her family.
My name is Yaeli Kamara. Eating Malombo fruit in Freetown, 1989. In Sierra Leone, the Saba senegalensis is called the Malombo fruit. My uncle Sonny cupped the Malombo fruit in his palms. Between his ebony hands, it looked like a tired orange that had rolled on an unpaved road for 1,000 years. He must have noticed me trying to peel the fruit, which is the first mistake anyone makes when they have never eaten it before. He squeezed it until a little bit of it fell out of itself, like a pulpy lava bullet, onto my grandmother's floor. I loosened a slippery knot of its tangy flesh and placed it in my mouth. Malombo was a flavor before English. Honeyed and tart, it slid across my tongue like a marble in a pinball machine. A stranger to fruits with pits, that which I could not chew, I pushed to the back of my throat. The pit swam in my throat like a tourist. My uncle laughed at me, puckered lips and bulging eyes. He told me not to worry, told me that before I had the chance to die or become a giant Malombo pit, it would pass eventually through me. On an early morning phone call from Oakland, my sister still says that this is her story, that her throat was where the pit lodged itself, and that Uncle Sonny had not laughed and grandmother's floor was the dirt outside, that it never happened to me, though I know it so well, the breathlessness of a thing being wedged in a place it does not belong. We cannot agree. The moment must be hers or mine. When we asked our mother who this keepsake belonged to, she split the ghost fruit between us. We tussle over a pit. We'd both rather choke than have no story at all.
That was poet Yaeli Kamara reading Eating Malombo Fruit in Freetown, 1989. From her chapbook, When the Living Sing, published by Ledgemill Press in 2017. Find links to more of Yaeli's work on our website, eartheats.org. And now I'll turn things over to Earth Eats associate producer, Alex Chambers.
Today, we have an interview about endocrine-active phytochemicals. And just in case you're not hooked already, you should know that the conversation is also about soy, BPA, climate change, monkey feces, and the genes in fireflies that make them light up. But let's start with some background. A while back, Earth Eats contributors Maddie Chara and Lee Bush interviewed Michael Wasserman, assistant professor of anthropology and human biology at Indiana University. He studies red colobus monkeys in the forests of Uganda to learn how hormones in their diets affect their behavior.
As an undergraduate at University of Florida and then working as a research assistant for a couple of years, I was studying the nutritional ecology of colobus monkeys.
Oh, wow.
So these are a group of primates that focus on eating just leaves, and they have this specialized digestive system similar to a cow's stomach, where they have symbiotic, mutualistic gut microbes that break down all the fiber coming in from these leaves. And I was also interested in hormone levels and ways we can measure hormones non-invasively without having to, you know, dart them or manipulate the animals in any way. And so by collecting fecal samples, you can measure the hormone levels of these animals, endangered species.
He was trying to figure out how to connect his interest in nutrition and endocrinology. The endocrine system regulates hormones in vertebrate animals.
And it's based upon a series of endocrine glands that are ductless, and they basically, each of them produces their own set of chemicals that they just kind of ooze out into the body that end up in the blood, travel around, bind to certain receptors in certain tissues, and then cause some kind of downstream physiological effect and potentially behavioral effects as well.
He took a class on endocrine disruptors. You may not know that term, but you've probably heard of BPA, that plastic you find in some bottles and food containers. BPA has compounds in it that mimic estrogen in the body. It disrupts the endocrine system. That got him wondering about natural endocrine disruptors.
And so I was thinking about, you know, I'm a primatologist first and foremost, studying monkeys mainly in the forests of Uganda. So I was thinking, you know, what's the natural kind of ecological evolutionary background to endocrine disruption? Is this something new from human activity, or is there some kind of natural counterpart? And heard of this term phytoestrogens, started reading about soy and how this soy has phytoestrogens in it.
Just to clarify, phytoestrogens, that's the estrogens that are coming from plants as opposed to the BPA and more synthetic.
Exactly. So a phytoestrogen is basically, it's a very broad term. It's any plant-produced compound that has estrogenic activity in a vertebrate animal.
So fish, mammals, amphibians, reptiles. In this case, it's monkeys. And he wants to know how plants affect their endocrine systems. But there's no reference manual for all the plants in the Ugandan forests that have those estrogenic compounds. The researchers have to follow the colobus monkeys around and take notes on what they're eating. Then they collect samples of the plants and bring them back to the lab and, well, you may not need to know how they figure out what's in the leaves, but it's kind of amazing.
We run what are called transfection assays, and this is a really interesting method where you take the gene that's responsible for the light that fireflies produce.
What? Whoa, cool.
And it's linked to estrogen response element in some cell line. Huh. So you have this cell line, you're linking this gene with estrogen response element, and then you take your plant extract and you add it to the cell line, and if something in there in that plant is estrogenic, the cells will light up. So you're looking for a light signal to basically allow you to say, yes, this plant has phytoestrogens, or no, this plant does not have phytoestrogens.
Magically, the cells light up to let you know when the leaves of this plant that the monkeys were munching on have estrogenic compounds. But that's just the plants. How do you figure out how they're interacting with the monkeys' systems? The answer to that brings us back to the non-invasive approach Wasserman came across as an undergrad.
To look at the hormone levels of the primates, you collect fecal samples. You have to know the individual to keep track of individual variation. And then you basically, you know, with folivores, it's really easy because the fecal samples are kind of like
leaf eaters.
Leaf eaters, yes. Yep. The samples are like rabbit pellets, kind of. Okay. So you
not too messy.
You see it fall.
Way better than my dog.
And then you wait. And actually, one of the best ways to find the sample is you kind of wait low on the ground because you know the general area, and then you'll see a fly, and the fly will lead you to the sample.
And the thing with these compounds is that they seem to affect the monkey's behavior. Of all the leaves the colobus monkeys were eating, they found three they ate regularly that were estrogenic.
One is Meledia dura. This is actually a legume similar to soy, and it's in the same subfamily as soy, so it's closely related. But here it's a tropical tree growing in the forest of Uganda. So the red colobus feed on the young leaves of this tree, and this food is the one item that significantly predicts changes in their hormone levels as well as changes in certain social behaviors like grooming and aggression. So we found the more they're eating these estrogenic items, the less time they're spending grooming and the more time they were in aggressive encounters with one another. Wow. It's correlational, so we can't really say that that's the cause and effect, but there was a study done experimentally where they had a captive group of macaque monkeys and they fed them different levels of phytoestrogens. And what they found was the groups that were fed the most showed similar patterns. So more time in social isolation and more time in aggressive interactions. So there does appear to be some kind of potential mechanism that interactions with the endocrine system through these types of compounds could influence these social behaviors. But, I'd say it's an area that needs to be explored further. I think one that's really interesting is, how does the chemistry of our diets not only affect our physiological health, but also can it have influences on behavior, animal behavior, human behavior, and so on.
So putting estrogens into our bodies sounds bad, doesn't it? But they're pretty common in plants, so maybe phytoestrogens are more complicated. Maddie asked Michael Wasserman whether these compounds are always bad for us.
No, not always bad. The endocrine system is always going to be disrupted, right? That's what it's there for. It's there to mediate the relationship between the individual and the environment.
Okay.
And to bring the individual back into homeostasis in the face of external stressors for part of the endocrine system. Other parts of it are regulating growth and development and so on.
According to the medical literature on soy, phytoestrogens tend to link up to the set of receptors in the body that suppress cell growth.
This has been suggested to provide benefits potentially to protecting against certain estrogen-dependent cancers, also for osteoporosis, reducing heart disease, and having positive effects on menopause and so on. So there are potential positive aspects to these compounds. So it's, that's why I try not to, you know, use the term endocrine disruptors here, because they could be negative, they could be positive.
Or there could be no significant effect at all. They could be completely neutral. It might just be a biochemical coincidence that these plant compounds act the same way as animal hormones when they get into animals' bodies. If plants are producing estrogenic compounds as an adaptation, it might be to defend against herbivores, so animals are less likely to eat their leaves and seeds.
But it's also possible that primates and other mammals, other animals, are seeking them out as a way to self-medicate or potentially even to regulate reproduction. So there's this idea that was proposed a while ago by Leopold in the 70s on a study of California quail, where they were looking at this bird feeding on a plant that had phytoestrogens, and they suggested that when levels of the phytoestrogens were high, nutritional content was actually lower in the environment, and it was a bad time to reproduce. And so it could be what's called a chemical cue, where the animal could cue in on it, consume it to suppress reproduction, so they're not going to waste all of that time and energy and then have offspring that don't have food to eat once they're born. And so this is an interesting, intriguing idea that, you know, I would say we don't have data to support or refute that in primates, but it's something that's possible. So that would be a benefit, right? Regulating reproduction to times of the year when nutrients are most available.
And it's not just animals who might be making use of these compounds.
And then actually, so with the plants that red colobus were eating that we found to be estrogenic, I then went and looked through the literature of studies on people and the use, ethnobotanical use of different plants. And actually, Meledia, not the same species, but a different species in that same genus.
That's the legume that's kind of like soy.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So I found that there was a report of its use, ethnobotanical use, to treat reproductive issues, which we have to make an assumption, right? But assuming that that's linked to the endocrine system. So there's a potential link there. And then the exact same ficus species is used ethnobotanically in Uganda for reproductive issues as well. And so I think that's an interesting area to explore, is moving into the human use of these types of foods and benefits of consuming these types of foods versus costs and so on.
Whatever we find out, though, might also be shifting under our feet. Climate change is with us, after all, and studies of soy have shown that changing temperatures and rainfall do affect estrogen levels. They affect plants in other ways, too.
There's a really interesting study that just came out looking at long-term nutritional data in Kibali in Uganda, where they found that with the climate change that's already occurred there over the past few decades, the leaves are becoming basically less nutritious. So they're having lower protein levels but more fiber.
Wow.
And we know that that protein-to-fiber model is really important for food choice in especially folivorous primates. Primates eat leaves.
Right.
So as protein content goes down and fiber goes up, that's not a good thing for kind of survival of certain types of primates living in those forests.
Another area Wasserman wants to explore has to do with figs. Figs are important to primates across the tropics. It's not that they're especially nutritious, but they're available year-round as a food source. He recently read a book called Ladders to Heaven about the deep history of fig trees in relation to human culture. In this book,
it's very thorough, and it's geared towards thinking about how figs can actually help us deal with climate change and restoration of forests,
because
they can grow pretty quickly and can grow in pretty poor conditions. And they're, as I said, they're an important food resource, not just for primates, but for lots of animals in the tropical rainforest, since they have this abundance of fruit availability. But the phytoestrogen part is missing, right? So this is something I think is really interesting that we found that one of the three foods the red colobus are eating that's estrogenic are the leaves of a fig species. And so one thing that I really want to, you know, do in the lab here at IU is explore the presence of these compounds in figs across the tropics, because I think that could give us some really interesting insight and further insight into that human-fig relationship over time.
For Wasserman, studying what primates eat and how changes in their diets affect their behavior and health can give us insight into human diets as well. More than we can get just by studying what we eat today. So, if you can't find him here in Bloomington, Indiana, he might be out in Kibale National Park, tracking down monkeys and their poop to give us new insights into the relationship between hormones, diets, and climate change.
Thank you, Alex, and thanks to Maddie Chera and Lee Bush for that interview with Dr. Michael Wasserman, professor of anthropology and human biology at Indiana University. Find links to his research at eartheats.org. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at PersonalFinancialServices.net. We can't let you go without a recipe. Listen up, folks. Chef Daniel Orr has a delightful meal-in-itself salad. Once you give it a try, I think you'll be eating it all summer long and into the fall.
Summertime, great time to eat salads. This is some wild rice that a friend of mine in Minnesota sent me.
The rice he's talking about is from Native Harvest. The wild rice, or manumen, is grown naturally in the lakes and rivers of northern Minnesota and is hand-harvested by Ojibwe tribal members using traditional methods.
I started with a cup of wild rice, then I added 3 cups of water, 1 peel from a clementine that had been dried, and then 2 bay leaves, about 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of black pepper, and then let that boil down until it was cooked. And you want to cook it until it pops. So you can see that when you put the seeds in there, they're tight little black pods. And when they're cooked, they explode and they open up. And then once wild rice is cooked, you want to cover it with the lid, because when it steams, if you let it just steam out, it will actually kind of contract and get hard again. So you want to, once it's cooked through, leave it covered, let it cool down with a cover on it. I'm also going to add 2/3 of a cup of toasted slivered almonds. And to make this kind of a main course salad, so this would be great to have for lunch, summertime, I'm going to add some feta cheese. So that's going to give us some protein, a little bit of saltiness. So I'm going to add about a cup of crumbled feta cheese. And then since we have an herb garden outside, I'm going to use some Thai basil. So I thought the Thai basil would be fun in this because it has kind of a licorice-y flavor. Will play nicely with the sweetness of the blueberries and the toastiness of the almonds. So we're just going to enrobe that with a little bit of olive oil. And enrobing is just lightly coating So I added about 3 tablespoons. And I'm not going to over-season this because the feta has salt in it and the Thai basil has that licorice-y pepperiness to it. And I'm going to let you taste it, Kate.
I love everything about that salad. The wild rice and the almond, so nutty. The fruit kind of popping and then that Thai basil. Yeah. All of it. It's just the feta, that salty, right. Creamy.
If you wanted to have this as a meatless Monday vegetarian meal, you could serve it with some soft tortillas. You could also serve it in some Napa cabbage leaves as a taco.
And you could just eat it.
Or you could just eat it.
I think I'm going to try to sneak out with it.
Believe me when I tell you that this dish blew my mind. I went home and made it the very next day. I'll admit, Chef's was better, and I attribute that to the quality of the rice. I'm going to look into ordering some of that wild rice from Minnesota. We have a link to Native Harvest on our website. Plus, of course, the recipe. EarthEats.org. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows. Helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Thank you for tuning in this week, and thank you to everyone who works on our show. That includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and all the folks at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Yaley Kamara, Michael Wasserman, Maddie Chera, and Lee Bush. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. For Earth Eats, I'm Kate Young, signing off. See you next time.